All right, well, let's end our studies this week by talking about keeping on, keeping on. That's what we're going to need to do. And so I want us to think about Paul's statement in Galatians 6 and verse 9, where he says, let us not grow weary of doing good, for in due season we will reap if we do not give up. If I asked you why you serve the Lord, what would you say? What's in it for you? Do you serve the Lord primarily for the short-term benefits, you know, the good things that we enjoy in this life as Christians, or do you have a longer-term view? Is there more involved for you than just the enjoyments of being a Christian in the here and now? You know, Job in the Old Testament was accused of serving God for what he could get out of it in the present moment. The devil, you know, cynically asked, does Job serve God for no reason? God had blessed Job with a wonderful family and with riches. Job had a wonderful life. And the devil's insinuation was that who wouldn't serve you, God, if you paid them as handsomely as you paid Job? But take away those things and you'll see that he will despise you. Well, the Lord knew better than that and allowed the devil to take away those things one by one. And what the devil found out, and maybe what even Job himself found out about his own faith, is that it was what it ought to be, that he was serving God with or without those short-term down payments of good things in this life. Job had far greater reasons to serve the Lord than whether it paid him in the short run or not. It certainly is true that righteousness will be rewarded. Hebrews 11, verse 6 says that God is a rewarder of those who seek him. But the primary part of that reward, and I emphasize the word primary, it's not all there is, but the primary part of the reward comes to us when this life is over. And so Paul says we ought not to grow weary of doing good because eventually there's going to be a harvest. You know, in due season we will reap if we don't give up before that harvest time comes. So I want to suggest some things that we must do if we have going to have the right attitude about all of this. And one of them is that we're going to need to learn patience as the Lord's people. If we haven't learned it already, we're going to have to learn the characteristic that the Bible usually describes by the English term patience. Although I think in modern English, we tend to use the word patience in a little bit different way than it would have been used in 1611 when the King James translation used the word patience. We usually think of patience as the ability to wait, maybe in traffic without getting mad or wait longer than we want to wait for something. That's one kind of patience. But in the Bible, the word patience is basically the idea of endurance, bearing up under a heavy load without giving up. And that's the quality of character, of course, that Job was known for. Under serious hardship and trial, he did not give up. He kept serving the Lord even when it became very difficult to do so. And so in that sense, we talk about the patience of Job. It's the ability to hold out, you know, to bear up, persevere, you know, would be a good synonym. And the reason people do what Job did, the reason people endure sometimes very difficult things is that they do have more in mind than just the short term. They're able to look above the present moment and look with a more long-term perspective. And so that's what keeps them going when the present moment, if that's all they thought about, you know, might cause them to give up. And James, you know, James is the one who talks about Job being an example of endurance or patience. James chapter 5 and verse 10, James says, as an example of suffering and patience or endurance, brothers, take the prophets who spoke in the name of the Lord. Behold, we consider those blessed who remained steadfast. And you have heard of the steadfastness. This is the ESV that I'm reading from. The steadfastness of Job. And you have seen the purpose of the Lord, how the Lord is compassionate and merciful. Job was able to put up with, if you want to use that expression, some hard things right now, because he, in his case, he believed he had a vindicator, a redeemer, that in the end was going to stand up and have the last say in court, and that's what he pinned his hopes on, that my redeemer will have the last say. There's going to come a time and all of these wrongs will be righted, and so he could wait. He could endure until that time. You know, there's just a lot of situations, even in this life, where we need to be able to do that. Now, if you invest in the stock market, you need to take a long-term view, don't you? You can't be too much concerned about the daily ups and downs of the market. First time it starts to go down a little bit, you can't sell everything you had and say, oh, you know, the world's coming to an end, I've got to sell all my stocks and cut my losses. No, you, to a certain extent, you've got to be able, because you trust, and I won't go into whether this is a well-placed trust or not, but you've got to trust that long-term, the U.S. economy is going to go up more than down, and so you invest for long-term profits. And that causes you sometimes to hold on and endure momentary ups and downs of the market because you're taking a more long-term view. Well, we've got to do that spiritually. Many years ago, when I was a young man, during college days, I was at a state university at the time, and was struggling in a lot of ways, and one of my teachers could tell that. And he was a very religious man, not a New Testament Christian, if I understand the New Testament correctly, but he thought of himself as a very religious man, and he called me into his office one day, concerned about me. He said, Gary, I can tell you're struggling. And I was. He said something I've never forgotten. He said, when the nighttime closes in around you, don't forget promises that the Lord gave you while the sun was still shining. Well, his point was a good one, wasn't it? There are going to be difficult days. There are going to be days when it will be dark and it will be difficult and it will be heartbreaking. But you know, right now on this side of the globe, the sun's not shining. But it's still shining. It's just not shining right here. We don't quit living just because we can't see the sun right now. We've got the confidence that it's still there and that momentarily it's dark, but the sun's going to come back up tomorrow morning. When difficult things happen, that doesn't mean the Lord's not still on his throne. It doesn't mean that the Lord's no longer the good God that we used to experience him being. And it doesn't mean that he's revoked his promises or that he's turned into some undependable kind of God. It just means that momentarily our vision may be clouded by difficulty, or we can't see the trustworthiness of our faith because of the tears in our eyes right now. But God's still on his throne. Everything is still what it ought to be. And for the meantime, we've got to be patient. We've got to hang on if that's what it takes. Patience is one of the great biblical virtues, one of the great characteristics that we are taught to, with the Lord's help, make a part of our character. The book of Hebrews largely is about patience and endurance, isn't it? Written to Christians, Jewish Christians who were wavering in their faith, perhaps thinking about giving up Christ and going back to the law of Moses. And so Hebrews is an eloquent plea not to give up, but to keep going. And so Hebrews chapter 6, for example, in verse 11. Hebrews 6 and 11. He says, we desire each one of you to show the same earnestness to have the full assurance of hope until the end, so that you may not be sluggish, but imitators of those who through faith and patience inherit the promises. Who are those who are eventually going to inherit the fulfillment of God's promises in a perfect sense? Well, it'll be those who do that through faith. Trust would not be a bad word to use there. And patience, endurance, steadfastness. Those who keep going. Sail against the wind, if that's what it takes. But keep going. Those are the ones who one day will hear the Lord say, well done, good and faithful servant. Jesus said in Luke 21, verse 19, in the New King James, by your patience possess your souls. I like the way the ESV renders that. By your endurance, you will gain your lives. There's a sense in which that's really what it all comes down to. All these other characteristics are important, but if you're not willing to endure hardship, none of the rest of it's going to make much difference. There's a sense in which it all comes down to whether we have the grit, if you want to call it that, to keep going. And no matter what, to maintain our trust that the Lord is still on his throne and he's still a good God, no matter what the present moment may look like, because we know that what's happening in the present moment is not the whole story. It just never is the whole story. So we've got to learn that quality of patience and gain our lives by our endurance, as the Lord said. The Bible uses the example of the farmer as the primary example of how this works. And that's not a coincidence. You know, it's people who work with living, growing things who know the most about the fact that sometimes you just have to wait. You know, if you're running a mechanical assembly line, you can speed it up. But corn grows at a certain rate, and you just have to wait for it to finish the process. Now, I know that we can put Miracle-Gro on our tomato plants, and that seems to affect the process a little bit. But basically, living systems have their own rhythm. They have their own time scale, and if you work with living things, you have to be able to wait until the growth process has reached its completion. If you don't know about that or you can't live with that, you won't be a good farmer. The farmer has to wait until the crop is ready to be harvested. That's, you know, it's an interesting way to make a living in some kind of a system where you don't get paid anything until the process is finished. Until the plant is finished growing, you get your, if you get anything, you get it at the harvest time. You don't get incremental payments along the way. You get it after you've finished all of that. So farmers need patience because they have to wait until the harvest time. They've got to wait for long-term results. The farmer gives and gives and gives and seemingly is getting nothing in return right now. Imagine a farmer that went out to his fields about two-thirds of the way through the growing season and just kicked up the dirt and said, "You ungrateful fields, I have worked and worked and worked for you since last spring and you have given me nothing." Well, if the fields could talk, they'd say, "No, and we're not going to give you anything until the whole thing's finished. Just wait. You've got to wait until the harvest." Well, that's the illustration that James uses. If you go back to James chapter 5, of the farmer, James chapter 5, verse 7, he says, "Therefore, be patient, my brothers, until the coming of the Lord. See how the farmer waits for the precious fruit of the earth, being patient about it, until it receives the early and the late rains. You also be patient. Establish your hearts, for the coming of the Lord is at hand." It didn't mean that the return of the Lord was imminent when he wrote those words, because that didn't happen. He means that we live in the daily expectation that it could be at any moment. And it may be. We live in that expectation. Meanwhile, what do? We wait, like the farmer. We patiently wait until the Lord determines that it's time for the harvest. And farmers know that it works that way. Spiritual people, the Lord's people, have to be able to wait as well. But there's something else that a farmer has to have that you may not have thought about. In addition to being able to wait till the harvest time, a farmer has to have a certain amount of trust. I mean, he may have planted crops for many years in the past. He may have seen the laws of nature work pretty much the same year after year, but the farmer has no absolute guarantee that the laws of nature are going to work this year like they always have. That is a matter of trust with him. That's well-placed trust. And he's got plenty of evidence upon which to base that trust, but it is an act of faith for him to believe that if he puts his trust in reliable principles and does the things that have produced a certain result in the past, that's going to produce the result that he desires this season. It is a matter of faith. And if a man not willing to operate on the basis of trust, he wouldn't make a very good farmer, would he? That's the way Paul uses the illustration of the farmer in Galatians chapter 6, where we've taken our text for this evening. But turn back to Galatians 6. I want you to look at some verses right above verse 9 that we've looked at. I want us to start reading in verse 7. Galatians 6 and verse 7. Paul says, "Do not be deceived. God is not mocked. For whatever," here comes the agricultural metaphor, "whatever one sows, that will he also reap. For the one who sows to his own flesh will from the flesh reap corruption. And the one who sows to the Spirit will from the Spirit reap everlasting life." And then it's when he says in verse 9, "If that's true, then let us not grow weary of doing good, for in due season we will reap if we do not give up." Who is it that we think normally needs to hear that part there in verse 8? "He who sows to the flesh will have the flesh reap corruption. He who sows to the Spirit will have the Spirit reap everlasting life." Who do we usually have in mind when we bring out that passage? It's usually the person sowing to the flesh, isn't it? And we want them to be warned that if you keep sowing that kind of seed, the harvest that's going to come up from that is one that's going to break your heart. You can't sow that kind of seed and reap anything but a bitter harvest. Sow to the flesh, you will on the flesh reap corruption. And that's true. That's half of this verse. That's half of what he's saying there. But that's really not the half Paul is interested in this verse. The half he's really interested in is the part of the verse that says, if you sow to the Spirit, you will of the Spirit reap eternal life. That's what he wants his brethren to be encouraged by. Now, it's sobering, seriously sobering to think that if we sow to the flesh, we're going to have the flesh reap corruption. But it's very encouraging to hear that if we will keep sowing to the Spirit, we're going to reap a spiritual harvest eventually. In the long run, if not in the short run. And we need to be encouraged to keep sowing to the Spirit when sometimes it may seem like it's not doing any good. Have you experienced that? I have. I expect you have too. There are days when it's just hard to keep going. You are strongly tempted to give it up. This is not working out. Why keep up the fight? And it's at those moments we need to have the patience of the farmer. Realize that the harvest time is not yet here. Let's not make premature conclusions about what works and what doesn't. Let's keep working in the confidence that the Lord said, this will work, it will work. In the long run, if not the short. But it is hard. I hope I'm honest enough to admit to you that it is hard for me to keep hold on to that truth day after day. Is that just some day? And I can't see the sunshine. Some days, when it's so hard, you just wonder, what is the point of continuing? That's exactly what the devil wants you to think. There's no point in keeping it. Paul would say, keep sowing to the Spirit. There will come a time, in due season, we will reap a harvest if we don't give up. So, to make a very poor pun, we need to cultivate both the patience and the trust of the farmer. Do you take the long view? We need to, but I repeat, it is hard. It is challenging. In the short term, it very often looks like God's way is making it worse. Sometimes it looks like this is not working out like we want it to work out. And that's just the way it is if all you look at is the short term. Solomon observed, I'm still holding on to the conviction that he wrote Ecclesiastes. I know that's not the contemporary view of this book, but it's still the right view. Solomon said in Ecclesiastes 9 and verse 11 that the race is not always to the swift or the battle to the strong. What does he mean by that? Well, think about it. In a foot race, let's say it's in the Olympics, last round. Can we be absolutely sure that the best runner, the fast runner, is going to win that race? No. That'd be, if you were a betting person, that'd be the way to bet. Not recommending that, but that's going to be a likely outcome. But on a given day, there are all kinds of factors that can play into the situation to affect the outcome. So that on one race, the fastest runner may not win that race. He may not feel particularly good that day. He may stumble before he gets to the finish line. There's 1,001 things can happen to influence the outcome of just one contest. So if you really wanted to know who was the fastest runner, you'd have to run a lot of races, wouldn't you, and see who won most of those. That would give you a better idea about who the fastest runner is. If all you just look at is one race, that won't tell you much. That's why in baseball, which anybody knows is the best sport, when we're going to determine the world champion, we play not just one game, but if necessary, seven. Now, the best team won't necessarily win the first game of the World Series, or the second. But if you play, if necessary, seven to see who wins four out of seven contests, you'll have a much higher confidence that that is the better team. Because repeating the contest tends to eliminate some of those extraneous factors. Well, what's the application? Solomon just saying, you know, the fastest runner doesn't always win the race and the strongest army doesn't always win the battle, just for the sake of saying that. No, there's a spiritual application there. We need to understand that you can't always tell what's right. You can't always tell who's the stronger power, God or his adversary? You can't always tell what's going to work and what's not, what won't, by looking at just a single instance, or in scientific terms, taking a very small sample. You've got to take a larger sample. You've got to take a longer view to eliminate some of those external factors that sometimes influence the short-term outcome. Well, life is certainly that way, isn't it? Aren't there days when you read the newspaper and it seems like the devil is winning in this world? And in your life, don't things happen that if you didn't have any faith would cause you to scratch your head and say, well, who is in control of this world after all? Aren't there days like that? Yes, there are. But you need to understand. But the short-term view is not nearly all you need to take into consideration before you decide who you're going to serve and who you're not, and whether you're going to keep going or not. You'll have to take a longer view before you make a reasonable decision about that. I love that song, "This Is Our Father's World." Oh, let me ne'er forget that though the wrong oft seems so strong, God is the ruler yet. Let me not forget it. Stephen, where was the verse when we sang Sands of Time about it were a journey well spent though seven deaths lay between? That's true. We're on a journey worth finishing. It doesn't matter whether it's a pleasant journey or a difficult one. It doesn't matter whether it seems like we're going to get there or not. If the Lord had said, sow to the Spirit and you'll reap a spiritual harvest in due season if you don't give up. You've got to keep going. in confidence, not blind confidence, but a well-placed faith in a God who has proven over and over and over again that his word can be counted on. If he recommends that we keep going, that's worth doing, just like Job understood that. Years ago, there was a young lady who came to me for some advice about her marriage situation. She was in a marriage to a fellow I knew, her husband, very well. And if I were a woman, I wouldn't have wanted to be married to him. He would have been very difficult to live with at that time in his life. He was very demeaning to her and selfish and just ordered her around. He seemed to think of her as his servant. And so she knew that I knew him very well and came to me to see if I had any recommendation about what she could do to help their marriage. All I knew know to do in those situations, just go to the text of the Bible and recommend what passages I think are pertinent to the situation. I did that. She said, "Gary, that's crazy." She said, I know him well enough. That just make it worse. That would just make it worse. I said, "Well, try it." Well, she did for about 10 days and then came back to me and said, "It's not working, and I told you it wouldn't." I said, "Would you just cool your jets for a little bit and give it longer than 10 days before you make up your mind whether it's working or not?" We need to be careful not to take an accusing attitude toward God when his way doesn't seem to be working to our satisfaction in the short term. Remember Moses' attitude after his first interview with Pharaoh in Exodus chapter 5? Now, Moses had had serious questions about this plan of the Lord to send him down there to deliver the people of Israel. Moses had all kinds of objections, and some of them are objections that I would have had if I'd been in Moses' position. The last time he'd been in Egypt, there'd been a price on his head, and the people of Israel had rejected him as their leader. He had no reason to believe that he'd be favorably received in Egypt in any kind of a way. And sure enough, after the Lord finally told him, go, he went. And when he went into Pharaoh, what did Pharaoh do? Well, he said, I don't know this Lord. I'm not going to let the people of Israel go. In fact, I'm going to make your burdens harder. Well, verse 22 of Exodus 5, Moses turned to the Lord and said, "O Lord, why have you done evil to this people? Why did you ever send me? For since I came to Pharaoh to speak in your name, he has done evil to this people, and you have not delivered your people at all." I can relate to how he felt at that moment. There's been plenty of times in my life when in some difficult situation I've studied the scriptures for what to do about that, and I've said, "Well, that sounds crazy, but that's what the Lord says. I'll do it." And I give it just a little bit of a test, and maybe it seems to make the situation worse. And so I come back to the Lord, much as Moses did, and said, "Lord, I could have told you that was a crazy plan. It's not working. And you just should have listened to me." Listen, we need to be very careful about drawing premature conclusions about whether the Lord's way works or not until we see what the end of the story is. You will only know whether the Lord's way worked or not when the whole story is finished. When the growing season has been completed and the harvest time comes, then you'll be in a much better position to say whether the Lord's way worked or not. Moses would be the first to say after 40 years later, yes, the Lord knew what he was doing. But it took 40 years of difficulty for us to see how this thing was going to play out. And how foolish of him to accuse the Lord of not doing anything just because the Lord at that moment hadn't done what Moses thought ought to be done on Moses' schedule. Now, how short-sighted we can sometimes be. The Lord has promised at least two things. One is that his grace will supply us what is necessary to deal with any difficulty. We've got to hang on to confidence in the Lord's grace. When Paul prayed three times for the Lord to remove his thorn in the flesh? The Lord's answer was, no, Paul, it'll be better for you to have to deal with that than for me to take it away from you, but I will help you deal with it. My grace is sufficient for you. 2 Corinthians 12, verse 9. It's hard to believe that some days, isn't it? That God's grace is all you need. A lot of days when it seems to me I need a little bit more than just God's grace. I need some specific help over here, Lord, please. And all he says is, be patient. I'm all you have to have. We've got to make a choice, no matter what happens, to believe that God is telling the truth when he says, my grace will be sufficient for you. Number two, God's faithfulness. We've got to hang on to the fact that he is trustworthy. He can be counted on. He is not going to let us down. His word is going to prove to have been trustworthy. That's the point in that familiar passage in Hebrews chapter 10 and verse 23. When the writer says, let us hold fast the confession of our hope without wavering. Why? For he who promised is faithful. You can lock that down. God can be counted on. But there'll be days when it won't look like that. The devil's going to make sure that there will be days when you will have very, very short-term evidence to question whether God's grace is sufficient for you or whether he is going to be faithful to you. But a long-term view, taking all the evidence into consideration, would cause you to see that there's more involved than what the devil would want you to believe when he puts, you know, blinders on you and wants you only to look at a part of the situation. So our emphasis has to be on the end of the story. And that part of the story hasn't been written yet. Hebrews chapter 12 and verse 2, looking to Jesus, the founder and perfecter of our faith, who for the joy that was set before him endured the cross, despising the shame, and is seated at the right hand of the throne of God. How did Jesus get through his ordeals? By looking at the end of the whole process. That's desperately what we need, a greater vision of the goal, the finish, the riches of our inheritance that we can't always see so clearly right now. I've said to you before, heaven is going to be worth whatever hardships we may have to endure in the short term, and they may be many. Paul said in 2 Corinthians 4, verse 17, this light momentary affliction is preparing for us an eternal weight of glory beyond all comparison. It almost embarrasses me to read that when I think of what Paul had to suffer and to hear him describe it as light momentary affliction. But you could suffer 1,000 times what Paul had to suffer, and it still wouldn't even tip the balances against the weight of glory that is waiting for us. But it takes a long-term perspective to see that, doesn't it? Let me just ask you, whatever blessings you have, and we all have very many, don't we, right now, but if the Lord were to allow the devil to do what he allowed to happen in Job's case, if every temporal blessing that you have in the here and now were allowed to be taken away from you one by one by one, how far down the list would we have to go before you gave up and quit the Lord? Is there anything, honestly, is there anything that you would have to say, I could give up this and this and this, but I could not give this up. I have to have this blessing. If there's anything like that, anything like that, if there's anything other than the Lord that you think you have to have, let me just say to you that what that is an idol that will destroy your soul. I don't care what it is. your spouse, your children, your grandchildren, your happy home, your health, your job. I don't care what it is. If there's anything you think you have to have other than the Lord, be very careful about that. You need to be able to say, I would serve the Lord. I would keep on keeping on, even if that were taken away from me. And I can tell you from bitter experience, that's a hard lesson to learn. I've had to learn to do without some things. That 30 years ago, I would have said I could not do without. And some days even now, I wonder if I can make it. But the Lord's grace is sufficient day by day to keep us going. And we rest in the faithfulness of his promise that in due season we will reap if we don't give up. Maybe I could put it this way. What does God have to give you in the here and now to keep you on his side? How much does he have to pay you to be his friend? That was Satan's insinuation against Job, wasn't it? Yeah, he's faithful. Look at how you pay him. Job was in it for higher reasons, and we need to be as well. Job could say in Job 13, verse 15, though he slay me, I will hope in him. Job had the confidence to understand that even if the Lord should slay him, that the Lord would have good reasons for doing that, that he may not be able to see right then, but that eventually it would become clear that that was the right thing to do. That wouldn't break his trust in God. There's a man who trusts God, who sees the evidence for God's trustworthiness that nothing can break, not even the taking away of everything. So we can say in Job 19, verse 25, I know that my Redeemer lives, and at the last he will stand upon the earth. And after my skin has been thus destroyed, yet in my flesh I shall see God. I personally think that's one of the earliest intimations of a bodily resurrection that we have in the Bible. Job had no idea how all that's going to work. For all he knew, he would die in this miserable condition that he'd been plunged into, but he wasn't going to give up. He's saying, if it takes it, I will see my Lord in the resurrection, if not before. Meanwhile, I am not going to give up. God can deliver us from any hardship, and sometimes he will. We pray to him and beseech him to remove certain problems, he will. But other times he will have a greater wisdom, he'll have a greater blessing in mind that will involve us enduring the hardship for a while. But even if he does not deliver us from this or that hardship, even if he does not deliver the people of Israel from their Egyptian slavery on the schedule that Moses thought, we still got to keep working the plan that God has given to us in the confidence that it is still worth it to serve him, whether this thing seems to be working out right now like we want it to or not. So to the church in Smyrna, in Revelation chapter 2 and verse 10, the Lord said, do not fear what you are about to suffer. Behold, the devil is about to throw some of you into prison that you may be tested. And for 10 days you will have tribulation, but be faithful until death or unto death, and I will give you the crown of life. Or to the church in Thyatira, Revelation 2, verse 26, to the one who conquers, the one who overcomes, and who keeps my works until the end, to him I will give authority over the nations. Therefore, Paul says in 1 Corinthians 15, verse 18, my beloved brothers, be steadfast, immovable, always abounding in the work of the Lord, knowing that your labor is not in vain in the Lord. If you studied Ecclesiastes, you know that our work in the Lord is the only thing that you can invest yourself in this world that you're not going to have to leave behind when you die. All the rest of it is vain in the sense of being fleeting and temporary and transitory. That doesn't mean they're not worthy causes to devote yourself to in this world. But there's nothing you can do in this world that has anything to do with anything more than this world except your work in the Lord. You can take that with you when you die. That's not in vain. So, let us not grow weary while doing good. For in due season, in the Lord's good time, in other words, we will reap if we do not give up. So don't give up. A few weeks ago, I was down in southwestern Arkansas for the funeral of a relative of mine. Some of you know I'm a member of the Copeland clan. My mother was a Copeland, and so J.D., who works with the group at Upper West Manhattan in New York, is a cousin of mine. His dad is a cousin. Many of the Copeland ancestors are buried in a little church cemetery down in Pike County, Arkansas, out from a little village called Deglite, Arkansas, I think. Maybe 300 people live in Deglite. It's at the last census. And so I have the cemetery for the funeral of a beloved uncle of mine. And this uncle was buried in the plot only two spaces over from my great grandfather, Copeland, patriarch of the whole clan. The space that I have reserved is right next to Uncle John, who buried just a few weeks ago. And I spoke to Keith Self, who's the warden of this little cemetery, takes care of the trust fund, takes care of it, he mows the grass, and keeps it nice for us. And so I said, Keith, do you remember when I was here with Basil Copeland several years ago and we came down here and I reserved that spot right there next to Johnny? And he said, yes, I remember. He pulled out his wallet. So I think I've still got that note in my wallet. It's been many years ago. And sure enough, he still had the note that I wrote on that day where I said, Keith, reserved that spot right there next to Johnny. He said, church, you get ready for it. It's yours. He said, half jokingly, what do you want to put on your tombstone? I said, I believe all you can put on there. He said, at least he didn't give up. So, I hope you will say. But that's all. Just keep going. Don't give up. Find somebody you can promise, make a public or semi-public promise. I'm not going to give up. I can't have a public record. So if you start wavering with the people who said this way, I heard you said you weren't. You promised you weren't going to give up. No. We're in a new season. People read. If we don't care. Wouldn't you like to know how much longer the working season is and the growing season? It'd be a long time. There are days when I sit down in front of that silly computer, try to write another page, and that blank computer screen stares at me, and I just nearly become physically sick. You say, I cannot write one more. Can't do this. What difference is it? But if the Lord would speak to me personally, he would say, Gary, write another page. It's going to work. And so we do, day by day, do these daily things that come to us as our part in the Lord's work. We all are a part of that. That's what you're doing. You're involved, I'm involved. We're doing what we can do. These little daily, ordinary things that may seem like they're no big deal, but in the long run, we get tired of doing them. We don't know how long we can do that. We work as a farmer works, patiently through the working season, the growing season, anticipating the harvest. Won't it be nice when it comes? Thank you for being who you are. For holding up the light of the Lord's work in your part of the world,
It's dark everywhere. It's not, you know, it may seem like it's darker in the Northeast than it is most other places, but it's just a different kind of darkness. It's dark everywhere. Thank you for us boldly being who you are, letting your light shine. As we end these studies, let's one more time sing a song, which will be intended for all of us, every single one of us, to ask, how will I respond to these lessons? What will I do? What change do I need to make? There's a change that some involves some outward step that we can assist you with, especially if you become a Christian in the first place, then we'd be eager to help you, to encourage you. So if we sing a song, there's any way we can assist you, take some step that you need to take in the garden of the Lord. And you just need to let us know and we'll be glad to help you with that. Won't you come up and stand?